Hello, and welcome to another episode of Flashback, Slate's podcast about classic and older movies. Joining me here in Slate Studios today, as always, is Kay Austin Collins from Vanity Fair. Hey, Cam.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty well. We both have a cold today. this is a warning to all our listeners.
Great.
There may be coughing, sneezing, general spaciness, but we have a really good movie to talk about.
Yeah.
So, The French Connection. I chose this in part because it was a much awarded movie at the Oscars in 1972. It won 5 Oscars, and this is our Oscar run-up season, little mini season. And yeah. I think actually that this episode will release on the day of the 2020 Oscars. So,
and this movie will, given the way things are shaping up, undoubtedly prove better than whatever wins this year. I'm just going to say it. I'm just going to go there, that this is a better movie.
I mean, can we just start off with that, like how surprising it is that this movie cleaned up at the Oscars?
Yeah.
When you watch it again, it feels so spare and modern and dirty and gritty and just everything that doesn't even appeal to Oscar voters now, but certainly doesn't seem like it would have appealed to them in 1971-72.
Yeah, with its sparse sense of psychology, as I was watching, I was thinking, I have such a slippery sense of who these people are, but I'm also enthralled. And I also wouldn't call it just a process movie because it is about police work, but not in the procedural sense. It's like a crime story and it's a drug story and it cares about class and all these things, but it just still, to me, avoids being pigeonholed in any kind of neat way. I mean, until the end, which I think knocks home what the movie is actually about and the kind of guy that Gene Hackman's character is. But until then, I'm just thinking, wow, this is such a weird Oscar movie. Like, no speeches, no two guys sitting together talking about, you know, the wives they left. The things that cops always do in movies to humanize. This just doesn't do those things.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone gets humanized, it's Fernando Rey's character, the French drug dealer, right?
Yeah.
He's the one who you kick off meeting his wife, and he has a nice little moment with her, and you have some sense of what his life is like, except for that little glimpse of Popeye's extremely rumpled apartment where he's handcuffed to his own bed.
Yeah.
You never get a sense of how the cops live.
Just a taste of that kink, 3 Days of the Condor, is what I immediately thought back of, this sense of, oh, is this an interesting new... This is telling me something about this character that it's not going to deal with in an explicit way, but somehow feels totally relevant. I have a question for you, because for me, this movie growing up, it was one of those, I won't say storied, but certainly to the extent that I had Oscar awareness, this was a movie that was always on my radar growing up. It was always in the air somehow as just a great crime movie that you should see, maybe partially because I grew up in New Jersey. I grew up in the Sopranos era. Crime stuff was in the air and men talking about crime stuff was in the air. But I was trying to figure out why I watched this when I was like 10, which is the last time I saw it, and definitely did not understand what this movie was about. So I was just wondering what your relationship was.
Oh my God, I want a movie about 10-year-old Cam watching The French Connection.
Honestly, my only thought was, this is really like dark looking. I don't understand.
Why are these guys
see.
So mean? My childhood memories of it, I guess, would be just people talking about the chase scene. I mean, I think I had already defined myself as some sort of pretentious, you know, tween cinephile by the time I would have heard about this movie. And it's the kind of movie that's always excerpted. It's the kind of movie that you know one thing about, and it's that chase scene. Although, watching it this time, I was amazed to see that the whole movie ultimately is a chase scene. I mean, there's, you know, this one that's always excerpted, Popeye Doyle chasing the train while in a car underneath. But really, there's foot chases, there's car chases, there's chases within chases. I mean, apparently Friedkin talked about Buster Keaton's The General being an inspiration for that train car chase scene. And really, the whole movie sort of has that structure. It's just a chase that gets madder and madder and madder, and, you know, with more and more elements, different kinds of transportation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, different people being chased, then them turning around and chasing the other people. And you can really see that Keaton influence in there.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but that's absolutely true. And yet, like, I mean, you're right. There's a point at which when you're watching it, you sort of realize that that's what you've been watching the entire time. There's absolutely the point at which a chase scene clearly starts. But they're always surveying. They're always on the hunt. And there's also this sort of sub-story about just their relationship to the job, their relationship to these kinds of crimes, the fact that they've been bringing in lots of petty criminals lately, that there are egoistic reasons why they might be involved in this, but the movie's not so singularly about that or any one part of their psychology to me that it ever feels like a corny, this is about guys who are too committed to the job. They are, in particular Popeye, but it just sort of minimalizes that stuff to just give you the work of what they're doing. Somehow, like, just looking at the work and looking at their ways of performing it, watching Gene Hackman walk into a bar and harass Black people, just, you don't really need exposition
right,
beyond
that. Well, what's so great about those early scenes that really throw you off by introducing these two cop characters and then just showing them brutalizing apparently innocent people for, I don't know, the first 10 minutes of the movie or so, is that you walk into the story of the French Connection completely unsure how to feel about these two guys. You know, they're not good guys. They're not bad guys. Some of the stuff that Popeye does is really scary, and he should probably not be on the force, right?
Yeah, right, right. But, no, he should not be a cop.
But at the same time, he's a character you can't stop wanting to know more about and wanting to understand his motivations, his obsession with this particular case. When they, well, this is way later in the movie, but when they take apart the car, right?
Yeah.
His trust of his hunches, even though, as Eddie Egan, the real life Popeye Doyle, who plays their supervisor, he plays his own boss, right? As he points out, your hunches have been wrong in the past, Popeye.
Yeah. I love when the movie's about someone and they're in the movie. That's just a thing that I love. And I also.
And he's a good actor.
He is a good actor. I didn't know until afterward that that was him. But also, right, the film gives you, with Popeye in particular, those details. But through a combination of things, one of which I think is the cinematography, which harkens a bit back to the fact that at the beginning of his career, Friedkin was a documentary filmmaker. And he made two features before this, but this is really the movie that put him on the map. And there's something about those long lenses, the sense of distance, the sort of non-glamorous lighting, where for a good portion of this movie, Gene Hackman and Roy Schneider, they just look like dudes to me. There are just a number of shots where I just think, this looks like Gene Hackman with a cold. Or like, this just looks like a different person, not a movie star.
Because they're washed out a little bit.
They're just so washed out, and they just sort of so easily blend into the behavior and the context of cops. I really do feel like I'm, not that it's so hyper-realistic that I forget that it's a movie, but I think it's a combination of those things and just writing that doesn't make them stop and converse in the ways that movies make you stop and converse, because we have to know who you are. But in real life, they know each other. They know their backstories. They know they're not married. They know that one of them's got like sort of kinky stuff and is probably too violent to be on the job. They know these things, and their behavior displays that.
Well, that's sort of what I mean about the propulsive forward motion of this movie, is that it's more about the action than it is about the characters or the characters express themselves in action, which is such a, you know, kind of acting cliche, but it is so literally true in this movie, right? I mean, you learn about Popeye from the way he drives, you know, and the way he beats up a suspect. I mean, the motions that he does with his body tell you everything you need to know.
So how did it win Best Picture?
Well, before we get into the movie itself, I have to read you the other nominees for Best Picture in 1972, because it's such a fascinating breakdown of exactly where the industry was at that moment. Because at that point, New Hollywood had sort of broken through, right? I mean, it was post, I don't know, Bonnie and Clyde,
right?
I mean, it's definitely a moment where there's starting to be a thing called New Hollywood. It's it's 4 years after Rosemary's Baby. But Hollywood is still in transition in that way. So the five nominees for Best Picture that year were French Connection, which won, Clockwork Orange, Kubrick's movie, so also something definitely from the new weird Hollywood, right? Fiddler on the Roof, which ended up winning a couple other things like Best Cinematography, total emissary from the old Hollywood, right? Like the last gasp to the musical kind of thing.
By the director of In the Heat of the Night, which is sort of the moment that we're talking about, the 68 Oscar moment where Hollywood splits between the In the Heat of the Nights of the world and the Bonnie and Clydes of the world.
Right.
And Fiddler on the Roof is by Norman Jewison, In the Heat of the Night, which gives you a sense.
Right. By the way, we're getting all this from Mark Harris's great book, Pictures of a Revolution,
which you should
read,
which we mentioned before.
We were saying we want one of those books for every year at the Oscars. Get to it, Mark.
We do. Please psychoanalyze every single year of the Oscars for us.
But then just to finish the list, so The Last Picture Show, really surprising that that was a nominee, and then did quite well at the box office that year, Peter Bogdanovich's breakthrough movie. Very small, black and white. I mean, just really not the kind of thing that you would expect to see on a Best Picture slate. And then going back to old Hollywood, Nicholas and Alexandra, which was a big period costume picture. So
I wonder if anyone talks about that movie today. Every other movie you just mentioned is a movie that people still talk about in some way, even Fiddler. Nicholas and Alexandra, no one has ever said, you should see this.
For the Oscars, that's a pretty good record.
I mean, it's 4 out of 5. That's way above average.
Well, this is not an Oscars podcast, so we won't go too far down this road, but it's very interesting to contemplate what it was about The French Connection that appealed to voters so much that they gave it Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, you know, that it won 5 Oscars that year. What were the other two?
Editing
and
adapted screenplay. And not cinematography, which is shocking to me, and not sound, which is also shocking to me. But to your point, I mean, part of the reason I think we are interested in this is because, particularly right now, you know, one of the things that has been a sort of side discussion of the whole Weinstein conversation that's coming out right now is also just how one of his effects on the industry was to sort of revolutionize the ways that people campaigned for Oscars. And we're talking about a movie that's pre-Weinstein, pre-Miramax, pre all of those things. You just wonder if studios, you know, aren't acting like political candidates to win. How does a movie like this breakthrough is really an interesting question to me, because I would suspect it has a lot to do with the chase scene, really the last 30 to 40 minutes of the movie. But I guess what stood out to me this time was that everything that came before that was also pretty valuable. I mean, it ends on such a gut punch of a note, for me at least, that I can see walking out of that theater being like, oh shit, well, I'm literally never going to forget this movie. And I don't feel that way about Fiddler on the Roof, I have to say. Clockwork Orange, I think, maybe that doesn't win because of the content. It's like too far into the violence, whereas this one's like morally ambiguous. That's still a safe zone, relatively. Really a good year, I have to say.
So maybe I'll kick off our discussion of the movie proper by mentioning the tagline of the poster. The original poster for this movie is kind of incredible. First of all, it's a giant spoiler. It's a still frame of the movie from that moment that Frog Number 2 gets shot on the subway stairs, which is something like half an hour from the end of the movie, right?
Yeah,
and it's sort of one of the big reveals.
The
right. So that's the moment that you see. And then the tagline underneath says, Doyle is bad news, but a good cop.
So I have a story for you, because I watched some of the special features on this, and in a documentary about the chase scene in itself, something that comes up about this specific moment that I think is very relevant to that tagline was that in the making of this moment, there was some discussion and hesitation over how the audience would feel about Popeye shooting a guy in the back, because that is officially bad cop territory. And Friedkin was sure that it would work, and sure enough, at the premiere of the movie, people applauded. And I think that that's just worth mentioning, because for me, this movie is again, in clear sort of ambiguity territory. He's a bad guy, but he's also after bad guys, and it's sort of weighing them against each other. But definitely shooting someone who doesn't have a weapon in the back is a clear no-no. But it's strange to hear that people were cheering, because I feel throughout most of the movie, sitting from my perch in 2020, that I'm really not rooting for anybody.
And I don't think Friedkin intended that. I mean, it's not Dirty Harry, you know?
Yeah.
He's not trying to get you to cheer on Popeye's bad costume.
Yeah.
Although it's also not an expose about police brutality.
Right. I mean, I think for Friedkin in a moment, it was a tension between, are we going to lose the audience in any way sort of wanting to believe it for the rest of this movie, this is a good guy, or something close to that. I'm sure that he didn't expect people to be cheering. Yeah, that's crazy. But I think that's why this image lands on the poster. I think that in a pre-internet moment, spoiler has a different meaning, because ultimately what people are being spoiled on is the fact that there's a huge chasing in this movie. That's the thing that everyone's hearing. And that image just invokes that. And we don't really know until the movie starts, and really even far into the movie, we don't really know what role this guy plays. You know, until the movie, we don't really know that he's the other part of this chase scene.
Another element of them deciding on set whether it was okay or not, I think, is that there were a lot of cops around. I mean, Eddie Egan himself, the inspiration for Popeye Doyle, was there acting in the movie and also advising on what happened. And I remember hearing some version of that story, too. I don't know if it was the same telling of it by Friedkin or who, but a whole lot of the extras and people playing cops in the background are actual retired cops.
Yeah.
And apparently they asked Eddie Egan himself, and he said, I would have done that. You know, it never happened. Happened, but it could have happened.
Okay, well, terrifying. But we're getting an interesting tension in the movie for me as well, which is, you know, since I saw it when I was 10, I've in the subsequent years learned a lot about just the history of New York policing, the economic history of New York. I would expect to come back to a movie like this and for it to be more brazenly political in some way, not political in the sense of like an outright political film, but more of a mentioning who the mayor is, like giving a sense of like the political climate that has led to the economic decay that is the thing that we're seeing on screen. In other versions of this movie, there'd be more discourse. You'd have your head up a little bit more from the action and you'd have a sense of context. And what I actually really like about this movie is that for the people living in the movie, do they actively think about, I don't think about de Blasio every day. I don't think about de Blasio every time
the subway.
Yeah, I know, right? I don't think about the New York politicians per se every time the subway makes me late, even though the line goes right back to them. And there's something really nimble to me about the way that this film is both very much about that moment in New York history, but we don't get the thing where we go through Times Square and we see all the sex movie theaters and
like in Joker.
Right.
Joker is at such pains to do exactly the thing that you're saying the
Precisely.
French Connection doesn't do.
Yeah. And a thing that films like French Connection with a very kind of documentary street feel did beautifully. That's why we have such a good sense of what those streets looked like. But this movie is not about that. And that is so interesting to me, because that, again, would make more sense for an Oscar winner. The film that felt like it was of its time. And this very much does, but without that discourse. It is so close to these guys and their job that you just lose that sense, because it's not about this whole circuit of drugs. It's really just about these guys are on to these guys and they're going to chase each other.
But I think then to me, what really makes it stand out, and I don't know if this would have been the thing that impressed Oscar voters or audiences who flocked to see this, it was the number two grossing movie of the year. Hmm. I don't know if this would have rung as big a bell with people at the time, but it's just the location work, you know? The fact that cinematography didn't win is really tragic, because there's so much of what makes this movie great is just its introduction of us into the city, the way that we feel that we're being almost thrown onto the streets with these guys, you know, with this very mobile camera that's always zooming in this great 70s way. Remember the incredible zoom where Gene Hackman, he's eating a slice of pizza watching the frogs have their incredible meal?
How could I forget?
And this, the camera zooms out to him through the window with his sad pizza. He pours out his coffee and then it zooms back inside the cozy restaurant. It's just, it's such a great use of that particular feature of 70s camera making.
Yeah, it really is. And also just this sense of surveillance all the time. You're just watching from like across the street. Just these long lenses where you just feel like the camera's not next to the actors. It's far from the actors and you're zoomed in on them, but you feel a distance between yourself and everything going on.
But
and
what subjectivity is operating the camera? It's so fascinating, right? It's the opposite of CCTV or fake security footage of some kind, because someone, some subjectivity is deciding to zoom in on that pizza guy and then back out again. The French guys don't notice him, right?
Yeah.
And so there's this presence of somebody who's kind of guiding you, but in this very chaotic way.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the sound design also does this. They're just frankly really creepy to me. Moments where you'll hear the two cops talking and you're watching what they're watching, but they're talking. I mean, so when I watch things at home, sometimes I use really nice headphones instead of playing the TV out loud because my neighbors get weird. And this has like lots of guns and stuff. So I just, but I was listening in my headphones and it's like they're whispering into my ears.
It's the third time you come here this week. Hmm. You got anything on this building?
The building's clean. I checked the tenant list. Remember Don Amici, the actor? He lives here. Oh, yeah, and somebody else. Does the name Joel Weinstock ring a bell?
Oh, you're kidding.
No, sir. He lives right here.
It was the bank on a shipment out of Mexico, was it 3 years ago?
Yeah, so I hear.
But I'm not watching them talk. I'm in the car with them, listening to them talk about something that they're watching.
Right, like when they watch Sal and Angie, right? When they stake out that diner for the first time. Incredible location,
incredible,
by the way. You can find online easily a list of all these locations and exactly where they were. And it would just be so fun to do a present-day French Connection tour and go to all these places. But when they're staking out Sal and Angie's place, you hear that. You hear Roy Scheider telling you all about them. And I don't know if you ever see him talking at that point.
Yeah, which is such a... Again, like surveillance state thing, the sense that people are being watched and don't know it and are being discussed and don't know it. But this doesn't really feel just like that. It really just feels like we're in the police work. What matters is that we're seeing what they're staking out and we're hearing the conversation, but it's not about watching two men talk. It's about staking out.
Right.
And that's
it's not a buddy
doing.
Movie in that
right.
way. Right.
It's not a buddy movie. And it's so easily, even these movies that try not to be buddy movies wind up being buddy movies because actors are charismatic and you like to hear them talk. And these guys, I really don't want to hear about. I don't want to. I literally do not want to hear about their lives. I don't want to know what kind of chaos they wreak on the people that they care about.
Well, there's crazy. I mean, there's little hints of their connection, right? Of what they mean to each other that are far from sentimental. But there is also some sort of camaraderie between them, which is sometimes kind of a scary camaraderie. Like in the very early scene where they have the guy up against the corrugated metal wall, remember? And Roy Scheider has a crowbar. Do you pick your feet in Poughkeepsie? That whole crazy questioning
session.
We're going
to have to come back
right?
to that.
Yes, I have something to say about that, and I will in just a second. But so there's a moment when Hackman just goes off on some crazy thing. Essentially, he's the bad cop, right? He's saying the scary stuff. He's inflicting the violence. And then the idea is that cool, calm, collected Roy Scheider is going to move in and get an actual answer to a question. And there's a moment when Hackman's saying something crazy. I think it's, "Do you pick your feet in Poughkeepsie?" which seems to be his favorite weird line, non sequitur, to throw at people. And the poor guy they're beating is absolutely terrified. They're all three in the shot. And then you see Roy Scheider turn away, hence toward us, for the camera, and he has this slight smile on his face.
"Hey, shithead. When's the last time you picked your feet, huh?
What's he talking about?
I've got a man in Poughkeepsie who wants to talk to you. You ever been to Poughkeepsie? Huh? Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie?
Hey, man, come on, give me a break. Hey, what you talking about?
Let me hear you say it. Come on. Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie? You've been to Poughkeepsie, haven't you?
I want to hear it!
Come on!
Yes, I've
You've been there, right?
Yeah.
You sat on the edge of the bed, didn't you? You took off your shoes, put your finger between your toes, and picked your feet, didn't you? Now say it!
Yes!
All right. You put a shield on my partner. You know what that means? God damn it! All winter long, I gotta listen to him gripe about his bowling scores. Now, I'm gonna bust your ass for those three bags, and I'm gonna nail you for picking your feet in Poughkeepsie."
Oh, and the smile is just sort of like, you crazy bastard.
Yeah.
You know, that essentially that he almost appreciates the artistry of Popeye's insanity and how it's setting it up for him to get some information.
Which really, we're going to get to it, but really sets you up for the end when Scheider is the one who says, "You killed this guy." And it's a big moment. And Roy Scheider is so good at doing both things. He's good at being the guy who would be a pal with this kind of cop. And he's also good at being the guy whose face tells you that this is a fuck up, whose face is both sympathetic to the person he's talking to, sympathetic to Popeye, but saying, like, this is not good. He's got one of those faces that can be hard, that can be sort of impenetrable, but just something in his eyes or something also allows at the right moments for him to be, of the two, if they were standing in a room, I'd probably, if I were trying to work two cops and try to get out of a situation, he would be my guy. There's something about his voice always. So yeah, when the moment you're talking about, when he turns around and smiles, it's actually shocking. It's shocking because he's the good cop. And then that immediately establishes something about the film. I gotta say, great acting from both. Are you a Gene Hackman fan?
Yeah. As it happened, I watched this the night before his birthday. I didn't realize it was, but then I got online the next day thinking about him and the French Connection and the character, and there were all these great birthday tributes to Gene Hackman, and it, so it made me sort of revisit just what an unusual actor he was. And I say was only because he retired from acting. He's still around. But I think said at a certain point, I'm done, right? Like, he hasn't made a movie in, what, 5-6 years? I'm not sure what his last movie was.
Gosh, I don't remember, actually.
Yeah, it looks like he hasn't made a movie since Welcome to Mooseport in 2004 with a comedy with Ray Romano. And I have to just say, I wouldn't mind him stepping back up just so that that's not his last IMDb credit forever.
Nope, he's ending on a high note.
But yeah, what a great career, and how much you see of that career to come in this performance, right? I mean, a thing that people often say about Gene Hackman is that he was always old. He always looked middle-aged, right? But you see a lot of the young man in his Popeye. You see, you know, what it would be for him to play someone who's completely instinct-driven and completely chaotic, you know, very different from the conversation, for example, the kind of very repressed, under control, you know, uptight guy that he was often good at playing. I mean, what's so great about his Popeye is that he could do anything at any moment. And you have no idea what will be unleashed.
And yet somehow it all feels consistent to this guy. That's what, like, really impresses me about this performance, that Popeye, I both know who this guy is, I know the archetype of this guy, but even knowing the archetype, he's someone who surprises me continually. Not even always in good ways. In certain ways, it's because he's such a bad cop in the quality sense. He's, like, bad at tailing people, as the movie makes very clear. He's, like, he's not the most skilled cop. He's the guy who can bully his way to some sort of conclusion. But it's not that he's, like, you know, some hyper intelligence. And I think that's really interesting, because I think then you sort of see, well, how far is brute force going to get you?
And doggedness, right?
And doggedness.
I mean, he works hard in his crazy way. He doesn't work well. A life coach would tell him to focus his energies differently.
Right.
But he is obsessive, and he takes this case farther than anyone would, even just the car scene near the end, right? I mean, just the mere fact that he won't give up on the idea that the drugs are in the car, and he ends up being right.
Yeah, I was just looking over his other films. He's got to be one of cinema's great assholes. And it could be mild asshole. It could be sort of sardonic, stylish asshole like Royal Tenenbaums, or so much less of the masculine man that he thinks he is, as in something like Unforgiven, his other Oscar-winning role. You know, he can be the fool, he can be whatever, and if he's being comedic, he's still usually playing an asshole character to me. But the range of things he can do, and his awareness, I think, of his physical stature and his face and how to use those things, just a perfect cop for this movie. But also just, a guy that I'm not going to try to predict, because clearly his whole thing is, well, I'm going to do what it takes, And you can predict that much. But
right.
What it takes is going to depend on the situation.
Well, and all those qualities you mentioned are a great contrast with Roy Scheider in this movie, too, right? And something that struck me watching the two of them together is that Scheider is totally feline and Hackman is totally canine.
Yes,
you know? I mean, totally. They have completely different styles in that way.
That's such a good point.
So even though this is such a New York movie and we have such a sense of the geography of the streets of New York, and I feel like that's really one of the strongest things in the movie, we don't start off in New York. We start off in this other very marked place
right.
that we get a very clear sense of in a really quick scene, which is Marseille in the south of France. And I wanted to mention that for a couple reasons. For one thing, so we can talk about what the French connection is historically and, you know, just this whole drug traffic ring that they're breaking up. But also just because to me, that little opening in Marseille is such a great scene setter for the movie, even though it is a completely different space. For one thing, it's a contrasting space, right? Marseille is this light flooded, very vertically oriented, just very different from the flat gray streets of New York that we spend the rest of the time in, right?
Yeah.
But also, in a way, that little mini scene that we have of this cop who we never learn who he is, a French cop, we assume, who's trying to tail Fernando Rey and then gets shot by Frog 2, right, in his vestibule. It's just a little mini version of what we're about to see, right? Which is a cop secretly tailing another guy, being in danger because of it. You know, even this class contrast that you see later on. I mean, this movie is all about people eating things while watching other people eating, right? Like, how many scenes do we get? We'll get to the incredible scene at Copain, the French restaurant that I'm dying to go to. But really, this is a miniature version of that Copain scene, right? We see the French dude having a slice of pizza.
That's right.
Then buying a baguette. I love that detail. Then walking through these streets of Marseille that we get a very clear sense of in that brief little moment that it's a port, which, of course, is important because that's why it becomes this drug trafficking center. And, you know, then him being shot by this other dude, who turns out to be one of our villains, Frog 2, who wonderfully takes a little nub of baguette with him after he leaves the killing scene.
God.
And it's just so stylish. It's a chase, you know, a little foot chase. And it just is essentially like a miniature version of the movie that we're about to see.
Yeah. And I really like what you said about just how it's even marked as a different space, because when I think about the New York of this movie, one of the first shots that comes to mind is during their foot chase that we were just talking about, where they run into this lot between two buildings. And I just, when I think of New York in this movie, I just think about being between walls or in spaces or contained, or because the buildings are so tall, you can't see the sky. Like, whereas in Marseille, the water is deliciously blue. The sky is beautiful. People look healthy.
Drug kingpin is living a great life.
Right. He's rich. He's fabulous. And it's just such a contrast to the world that the heroin users are going to be in, the world of New York. So the French Connection itself was the huge smuggling operation that brought heroin from Turkey to France and from France to the U.S. And I didn't realize this until looking it up, but this French Connection that started in the 30s and really maxed out in the 60s, and this movie is documenting one of the things that sort of broke it all apart, but that heroin use in the U.S. was largely attributed to this line of import, which is crazy to think about, which is, I mean, it's just like a part of the history of heroin that I really, again, I saw this for the first time when I was 10. There were certainly a lot of films about the drug trade, broadly speaking, and there was already a bit of nostalgia about the 70s drug trade in particular. You know, I was already seeing movies and reading things about that, but I think the international reach of this is unique. Like, it's something that I associate with just not this era of crime thriller, which really probably would have stayed in New York, or if it had gone to these other places, wouldn't have been, I think, so like historically pointed about it or something somehow. It's just like, it's called The French Connection. It's about a French guy that they don't know, whose voice they've heard, that they have to hunt down. But it is such an international conspiracy without the movie being about conspiracy. It is like actually a big deal that this movie is about. It's like a big thing historically. And the movie doesn't go out of its way to say this is important, but I can also, just from seeing how these people operate, have such a clear sense of how they evaded the law for so long. It's weird how it's like so historically useful, but the movie is not, for all the ways it's about something historic and true, fictionalized, of course, it's not a history lesson. You know, I don't really, until the end when I get those cards about how these were real people and what actually happened to them, I completely lose sense of that, because it's just, again, it's so close to these guys in this job that they're in the dark. They don't realize how international it is. Nobody does. Yeah, I'm trying to imagine what it must have been like in the 70s to see this, and you start in Marseille and you're just like, did I walk into the right movie?
Especially for something that's kind of low budget, as this movie is, right? I mean, in the modern day, this would have all kinds of drone shots. You know, you'd be establishing what country you were in with all kinds of legends and titles and exposition. Right.
Yeah.
And even that part in Marseille, I mean, they had to go abroad to shoot it, but it has a very street kind of feel.
Yeah, it does. But I need to get back to this other thing. Do you pick your feet? Can you talk to me? Like, I get that it's a non sequitur that is used to confuse people, perhaps, but what the fuck is he talking about?
I mean, as far as I could tell from researching around the movie a bit, it's an Eddie Egan thing. I don't think that he actually used that line in real life, but I think he used tactics like that. And, you know, that the screenwriter, Ernest Tiedemann, adopting the material, decided to think up a line that would be Popeye's non sequitur line.
And that's the line they came. I guess it's so mystifying because, I mean, I feel the way about the question that the people in the film must feel about it when they hear it, which is, what? But in the sense of, like, it's such a weirdly specific and, I don't want to say intimate, but you're asking about a thing that someone might do that no one has ever asked them about before. It is genuinely a good way to stun someone into what the fuck and then do whatever you're going to do to them. But I just wondered if there was some sort of cultural thing that happened with the feet picking that I was missing, or
maybe there's some
kind of
listener
joke
who has more information than that. But as far as I can tell, it was the screenwriter's attempt to give Popeye a tagline that he can feel like to confuse subjects with. And I think that's part of what Roy Scheider is laughing at, is the completely bizarre nature of whatever his question is. And if you remember, at one point, his supervisor, played by the real-life guy, says, oh, are you still picking your feet in Poughkeepsie? So it's gotten around the department. Everybody knows that that's Popeye's line.
God, I wish just one of them asked, what do you mean by that? can we actually pause for a second and talk about what you're talking about? I mean, one of the complexities of, I think, Gene Hackman as an actor, but also this character, this is, again, one of those surprising things. Like, it's just a tactic, but it's just, you don't see where that's coming from. Another thing that I think of with regard to that is in a scene that comes soon after, when they go to a bar that's full of black patrons who happen to be drug dealers. And there's something about that scene, both leading into the bathroom and coming out of it. Like, we get the bit. We get the, I have to look like I'm beating up on this guy so that no one's onto him because he's undercover. He is also, by this point, he's used racial epithets. He's, like, very clearly a New York cop in the 70s. I think what a lot of us think of that is just someone who is the opposite of someone who is politically correct, who has a lot of disdain for people broadly, but certainly expresses that in ways that are through epithets, etc.
Yeah, I mean, he says the N-word within, what, the first 10,
pretty
15
early
minutes of the movie?
So, and there's just something to the way that he's beating up on this guy, where when they're palling around, I was surprised that the guy was just like, hey, could you, like, not overdo it? Because maybe pleasure is the wrong word, but he overdoes it, I think. I don't think he needed to convince anyone that badly. Or maybe he did, but there's just something about the fact that he, either way, would not hesitate, I think, to beat up a black guy like this in this way. And something about that interaction, it just is so vexatious and odd and unsettling for me in a powerful way.
Well, and for modern viewers, it's just very strange that he never gets his comeuppance for that, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
A protagonist who is that blatant of a racist in a present-day movie would at some point have to sort of come to terms with that, with another character, right? I mean, the story in some way would bring them to a confrontation with someone about that feature of their character.
Right.
And with Popeye Doyle, it's just a part of his personality that he is a racist. I mean, Roy Scheider notices it, right?
Right.
He says, that could have been a white guy when he first uses the N-word, remember?
That's right.
And then he says, don't trust anyone. So it's marked by another character, but there's not really a moral judgment of it in the movie that I can see.
Right, which I completely agree with you, would, I think, be difficult for many people watching it today, if it came out today, to wrap their heads around, because I think we, at this point, expect art to show awareness of how bad the people in it are. Whereas I think there's another school of thinking on this that says, you show how bad they are by showing how bad they are, and moral distance should be something that you know to have, that there's a way to depict these things that doesn't feel like an endorsement. And I have to say, I don't really think this movie is endorsing any of this.
No, because it also contains characters who object to it, whether it's Roy Scheider saying that or the guy in the bar who says bullshit.
Right.
Remember when he's turning away, the guy they call fatty or whatever?
Right. But those things don't amount to the movie saying, FYI, everybody, we know that this is bad. We know that this is a bad kind of policing. Whereas I think that actually people might expect you to do more of that today. Not everyone. I think a lot of people can sort of watch these things and let them go.
Let's talk about chases, since the entire movie we have now established is basically the general, right? I mean, it is one chase after another. I mean, for example, the foot chase on the subway where Fernando Rey is kind of trying to outsmart Gene Hackman. Yes. It's just a gloriously staged action scene.
It really is. And it's very much an action scene, but there are no guns. It's like not violence, but it is action. It's pursuit. It's on the street, then underground. I have to say, I wonder how you felt watching it this time, but I was surprised by how long this was, in a good way. I was surprised that the Fernando Rey character, Frog One, toys with him for as long as he does. It becomes a substantial thing on the train, off the train, or even before that, into the flower shop, out of the flower shop, on the street, underground, on the street again, tricking Gene Hackman every which way. It is very clear early on that he's been made.
But you don't know how early he knows it, right? I mean, there's some period of time, obviously by the time they're on the subway, he knows it, and he's doing all the stepping on and off the cars, which is just, it's so slapstick and so beautifully staged. But but there's a big period before that, which is one of my favorite parts street-wise, too. I mean, just some of the greatest sights that you see on the streets, whatever part of town he's walking through. And do you notice that Gene Hackman keeps stopping underneath signs that are in French? Everywhere you go, there's like Le Dernier Cri and the Copain restaurant. There's all these little notes about Frenchness everywhere. But I think that scene, for the vast majority of it, you're not supposed to know whether Fernando Rey knows or not, right? And so it might be a chase that he's being led on, or it might be a stealth stalking. And I would love to watch it again with an eye to that, to just try to figure out when exactly does Frog One figure it out.
Right. Part of the reason I think that it must happen early is because even before this sequence, there's another moment of pursuit earlier on. I'm having trouble placing which, but it's like it's not as big of a set piece, but there are moments, because I think this film is so good at giving us the POVs of the cops as they're staking people out, that there were moments early on where I thought, if they don't know you're there, they're stupid. One of you's stupid. Someone in this movie is being stupid. I'm guessing it's the cops. I just figured Gene Hackman he's out on the street all the time. He's hanging out, like in that restaurant moment. He's not even trying to stand in the shadows or or behind a car. He's just like directly across the street staring at them, eating a pizza. Who does that? I just figure he must have been made early on, and that everyone knows they're being tailed, and that this drug transaction, everyone knows that it's under the eye of the cops in some way. They maybe not the full extent of it, but I feel like these guys have got to know.
They're just too cool to even bother. I mean, a modern movie would probably at least have a close-up where you see Fernando Rey glancing across the street out of the Le Copain window. But no, he just nibbles on his escargot happily. Brief sidebar on the meal that they eat.
Oh, yes, please.
They start with escargot. It looks so delicious. It's such a 70s kind of French meal.
Absolutely.
Right? And then they're getting offered this wine in a basket. I love it. I was craving that meal so badly. I was essentially Gene Hackman with the cold piece of pizza tragically staring in the window. And then they have some French onion soup.
That's right.
And then some sort of delicious sliced steak that's sliced right at the table.
That's
the
right.
The only part that is sort of bad 70s food is their dessert, which looks a little bit gelatinous.
What was their dessert?
It was some sort of tart, but it was a little bit, you know, with that like cornstarchy top that looked like it was from an old Jell-O cookbook or something like that.
I would have
but
loved another more moment close-ups where, on the food.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, it's a great food movie. There's food galore.
It really is.
But even just, again, the way that kind of class distinction is established, right?
Yes.
It's not even like Gene Hackman wants in to the fancy French restaurant, but he just inhabits this whole different world. And
absolutely.
I think there's even a joke about, do you want red or white?
Yeah.
Remember when Roy Scheider brings him the coffee? So they're very much aware that, you know, this guy is living a life, a privileged life that they will never have access to.
Absolutely. Your class point's really interesting to me as well, because the contrast that the film makes between the black guys in the bar and the French guys with the heroin is so interesting to me. Again, a kind of contrast that this movie didn't invent. And I think for a long time, authorities have known that as much as policing on the ground and the war on drugs in the U.S. is happening, it's long been clear that internationally we need to be thinking about the drug trade and fighting it. But there's just something about the contrast, and also just the way that you get to treat the lower class people and the ways that the French rich guys, the celebs in a way, can completely evade you, but also you can be tailing them for so long and never get to put your hands on them in the way that you can just walk into a bar and harass and harass people of color and lower income people. Like the gap there, like part of what feels frustrating for Hackman for me is just that the French guys are out of reach. They are literally out of reach. He can be standing across the street. There's nothing he can do to them. Whereas he can walk into a bar and just harass whoever he wants. There's such a difference. And again, this is something that the movie doesn't, there's not a moment where someone discourses on that subject. It's just sort of there in the parallels and the contrasts.
Right. Even among the bad guys, right? I mean, there's all kinds of hierarchy going on among, you know, Weinstock, who's sort of the American equivalent of the French guy, right? The guy who's living in that fancy apartment with the Japanese screens and everything. Again, it's not that pointed. Nobody ever really tells us exactly who Weinstock is. But what matters is he's at the top of the pyramid. And then there's all these guys below him, Sal being the one that we get to know the best, Sal Boca, right?
Right.
Who are just trying to do the right thing, trying to please him, trying to sort of learn the drug trade, you know?
Right.
And that scene where Fernando Rey goes down to Washington, D.C. specifically for the purpose of meeting with Sal Boca. Why exactly they couldn't be tailed down there, I'm not quite sure.
And they were, so it doesn't even matter.
Was there a cop in D.C. on them?
There's a cop who follows them, and he also just buys a round-trip ticket. And at the end of their conversation, you see him on the steps of, I forget which monument it is, but you see him in the distance. But he's not really a character. There's nothing he can do. He can only tail them.
Right. They're not breaking any laws for the moment, right? They're standing
around
talking.
You can be French and fly around in the U.S. That's not a crime.
But even just the sort of lesson that Fernando Rey gives to the Sal Boca character there, where he's sort of saying, you know, we've got to move it along. We can't chill out. You know, there's this kind of power play going on between them. And it struck me a few times, and maybe it's just because of the physical resemblance or the time period, but Sal Boca seemed to me a little bit like a Fredo Corleone kind of character, you know, this kind of wannabe gangster who always seems to be sort of yearning for more power and glamour than he actually has, because he has this lousy diner with his girlfriend.
Right. I thought a lot about these same things. Sal's conversation with Weinstock, the generational gap there in terms of just, you know, the way we do things in the business is we wait. This is a huge amount of money. Nobody would do this so quickly. Whereas Sal's the young guy jumping at the bit who's like, no, we got to do this now. We got to do this now. The sense that he's wanting to rise into power, but he also, by this point, he's already got his own cops tailing him, right? He's like important enough that he is probably thinking about making his own moves. I feel like there's a version of this movie in which he goes out on his own and F's everything up for himself by trying to get too ambitious and pays a price for it. But I also like this version where there's a tension there in the way that he wants to do things and the ways that the other men want to do things. And they all have their own interests. And the movie's not about us sitting down and listening to them talk about those interests. They're just very clear to me. This is sort of where some of the tropes of just crime stuff sort of fall into play. I can fill in these gaps for myself. But it's the fact that the movie even takes the second to even just like analyzing the purity of the heroine is somehow thrilling and suspenseful.
Did you know they used real heroin for that scene? And that is the real method.
Not.
Isn't that incredible? And that's the actual chemical method that they use. So that was Friedkin being a documentarian right there.
And
also, just
illegal.
Side note, the guy who tests the heroin, fantastic. The actor who gets two scenes and the way he describes it. Oh, it's so good.
Fantastic.
Dynamite.
Just one of the many illegal things that were done in this movie to make this movie happen. We're definitely going to have to talk about illegality regarding the chase scene as well. I did not know that was real heroin. Why did they tell people that? Why would you make that public information?
I know, especially for Eddie Egan. I mean, he's got enough bad things on his record.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy. No, but it's like, I feel like I've seen a scene like that a million times before. It's just thrilling to watch the care, the art of it for something that is so bad.
For some reason, the actor really reminded me of Pierre Clémenti. Do you know who that is? The French actor who's in so many Buñuel movies.
Yes.
And of course, Fernando Rey is from the Buñuel world, right? But I could completely picture someone like Pierre Clémenti, who is, how do you even describe what he is? He's this sort of wisp-like, gracious figure, but he always played really seedy, tough guys who had some sort of strange kink.
Yeah.
And that's how that guy seems. I'd love to know his backstory.
I would as well. And yeah, he's just as good when this comes up again later, and even more suspenseful when it comes up later.
All he does is smile in the
second
scene.
All he does is smile. And it's just all you need are just the cuts from him to other people's faces, and you know how anxious they are. Also, this is jumping ahead, but that's also a moment where we actually don't know the status of the heroin in the car, like what the cops did with it, if that's the real stuff or whatever. We don't know. There are like little suspense things built into this movie that you would think wouldn't work because I don't think about the characters in terms of them as people. It's suspenseful not because is the guy testing the heroin going to die or something. It's not suspenseful in that way. It's just, it can be really enthralling to just watch people do things extremely capably with an extreme assurance of knowledge and just work out the little systems that they have between themselves. And it's all about relations. Like that to me is just as thrilling as this is my life story. And this is the movie about the arc of that story.
Well, I think that answers the question of why use real heroin, right?
Sure.
I mean, it's kind of about material process at that moment.
Sure.
The same way that the car destruction scene goes on and on and on and on. And it's fascinating, especially after they start getting the idea about the panels. But it's a very long time to watch guys just use a crowbar to pull a car apart.
Yeah. And again, a thing you've seen before. But yeah, watching it here, I was like, wow, you guys are really, where's the car left? Like, there's nothing.
Well, what's crazy is they return it to the French guy, who we haven't talked about, the dupe TV French guy, but they return his car and it looks perfect. So, you know, they're a good body shop there. They buffed it out very nicely.
They sure did. That might be my one.
Verisimilitude.
Yeah.
Problem.
I mean, there were no scratches on the car when they gave it back. I was a bit confused.
So after the DC meeting is when things really get rolling in terms of the plot and also in terms of the action. And it's when this big extended chase, which is really several different chases placed end to end, starts to happen. So can you explain to us what exactly happens so that we get Popeye Doyle driving underneath the elevated train, trying to catch it in a Pontiac Le Mans?
Right. Well, it's an interesting, I think, structure to the plot, because really the case almost ends for these cops when Doyle loses Frog One on the train, because that's when Frog One goes down to D.C., has a meeting, and back in New York, the cops are being told, you guys have been on this case for months and you don't have anything and you lost this guy in the subway. And this is happening during a car accident scene that is very violent. But you have the overwhelming sense of you're sitting on something that's not happening. There's nothing happening on this, whereas people are dying. And that is when Popeye goes home. And right in front of his building, Frog 2, sniper on his roof, tries to kill him and kills like a woman walking her baby instead.
Totally horrifying moment, by the way.
Totally
the baby
horrifying.
Cries through the rest of the scene.
And other women trying to...
Nobody seems to be saving the baby in the baby carriage. So you're thinking about that the whole time?
You're thinking about that. And you're also, I mean, for me, this is going to sound really bad on my end, but the irony made me laugh aloud. Not the woman getting shot, obviously, but the sense of... Doyle had just been told that they were basically being reassigned and they weren't on this anymore. If the sniper had not tried to kill him, they wouldn't have been caught. The cops really are off the case. But the sniper trying to kill him is really what sets things really, really into motion. And this is the beginning of the chase. It's the beginning of, you know, Doyle outside his building, then into a building, gets to the roof, sees a guy running away, and then we just full out have a chase.
Right. And it's a real runaway, literally, kind of chase, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because the chase keeps getting more and more out of Doyle's control.
Yeah.
First, the guy gets on the subway, and Doyle's not aware of what's happening on the subway, right? He's not even aware that the subway has been hijacked necessarily. He just wants to get to the next stop before the guy does.
Right. The shooting style and the range of POVs that we get in it is actually really nimble and really complicated because, yeah, there's all this action on the train with a cop who I think gets a sense from Doyle as he's not making it onto the train that there's something going on. I think he's across the platform. And the cop just sort of looks at the French guy, gets suspicious. The French guy starts acting suspiciously, and then he shoots him. And then it just becomes two stories. One of Doyle trying to get to the next train stop and one of the French guy on the train doing what he has to do to make the train not stop at that stop as people become increasingly scared and suspicious and the other conductors start handling things. Yeah, we're just alternating between we're under the train, we're on the train, the POV of the car that Doyle steals from a normal, everyday U.S., you know, New York citizen.
Separate movie about that guy and the rest of his day.
Completely, right. It's just thrilling that, like, you're watching these two stories happen at the same time, but there's just something about one being under the other, always able to see it.
This was the thing I think that Friedkin was trying to do when he decided he was going to make a chase to end all chases, which apparently Howard Hawks told him to do. Did you know that he dated Howard Hawks's daughter, Katie Hawks?
Oh my God.
So at the time he was prepping this movie, he was seriously involved with the daughter of Howard Hawks. And so he's sitting around talking with Howard Hawks about movies. Apparently Howard Hawks had no respect for his movies and thought everything he had done up to that point was trash.
His own movies or Friedkin's?
No, for Friedkin's.
I was going to say.
And Hawks gave him various pieces of advice. One of which was that he should watch A Place in the Sun over and over because it's a perfect movie. So I love that. But he also said, do a chase to end all chases and one like nobody has done before. And so this idea that it would be, you know, a car chasing a train that was up above it, I think came in part from the Howard Hawks inspiration. Another little point about the train scene and everything that happens on board the train with the hijacking. Did you know that the cinematographer for this, Owen Roizman, also shot The Taking of Pelham 123, one of the great train chase movies
ever? One of the great Yeah, New York movies ever. Yeah. Oh, that makes complete sense. That's beautiful.
So, yeah, somebody who, you know, knows his way around the inside of a racing New York train and how to use real locations in an incredibly convincing way where you can actually read the signs and figure out what direction they're going in and where they are.
Here's the thing. Back to that illegality stuff. I didn't know this until I watched the features on it. But when they shot this scene, unless they're all making it up, and this is the kind of thing that I think that they sort of regret doing, so I imagine they're not making it up. You know, there was no police control. Like, this was shot live. They didn't handle cross-traffic. Like, the people that you see looking confused in those shots are people actually looking confused. If they put a cop siren on top of the car, and that was a thing that sort of alerts people to the presence of the car and to the need to get out of the way. And you don't hear that in the movie, but that this scene was largely not improvised, but my impression from Freakin' is that they really did a lot of, this would be cool.
Yeah.
But also that the accidents that you see, including one where Gene Hackman crashes, that those aren't fake.
I had read a bit about that. I didn't watch the director's commentary as you did, so I think you know more details about it, but a lot of this stuff was done without a permit, right?
Yeah.
Also, the traffic jam on the Brooklyn Bridge much earlier in the movie had apparently been done without a permit, with a lot of retired cops standing around sort of helping to mess up traffic.
The 70s. I don't even know what to say.
But yeah, you can feel that freedom, and it's a scary, chaotic freedom during the car chase because it was really Gene Hackman behind the wheel, although there was, I think, some stunt driving.
There was, some
stunt
driving.
By Bill Hickman, who plays the FBI agent, Muldrig, who gets shot at the end. Apparently, he was better known as a stunt driver than as an actor, and he had actually driven, you know, the famous car chase in Bullet with Steve McQueen.
Yeah, right.
He had been the driver of the other car, the one that Steve McQueen is chasing.
The movie I got to rewatch. I love a chase scene.
That terror that you sense in Hackman's eyes and that you feel for him.
Yeah.
I don't think it could have worked if it had been all carefully permitted, you know, and that every extra had been informed exactly what was going to happen. I think the lady that crosses with the baby carriage was a staged moment, but lots of the other moments are clearly not. And so it makes it so much more sickening. That way the camera is mounted to sort of very low down on the front of the car. I was thinking about how, you know, people love to say now that that movies feel like video games or it's like a single shooter game or whatever.
Right.
I mean, this is way before video games. And there's that feeling of a POV, you know, and kind of moving through this space in this uncontrolled, scary fashion.
It is really scary. And really, it's also just good. I mean, it won the Oscar for editing for a reason, because it so seamlessly weaves in the real chaos with, the woman crossing the street with a stroller, which, again, is like a not uncommon thing that happens in these movies. But
Battleship Potemkin.
Exactly. But here it was like, you know, that's just a zoom. But it's so well edited that it just feels like the car is careening into her.
Well, it was undercranked too, apparently.
Yeah,
it was deliberately
sped
up, you know, which you can sort of see if you look at the details of the pedestrians and stuff.
Yes.
So to give it even more of an insane, apparently the fastest a train could go at that time, a New York subway train, was 50 miles an hour.
Right.
So
right.
Even if he was matching the subway, he was not driving that fast, but it has this feeling of just being utterly out of control, and that Popeye could die. I mean, the first time, if I had not seen this movie before, I would think, well, this guy's going to get his comeuppance, this dumb racist cop. He's going to crash into some piling, and that's it for him.
Instead, he kills the guy. I'm still wrapping my mind around the audience applauding, because I do think what they are applauding is also just the sequence in itself. It's just like incredible, incredible filmmaking. But it's not quite a win. First of all, it doesn't solve anything. And also, the movie's got these other things in mind for him and his relationship to the people that he's hunting down.
Well, there's so much of the movie left after that, right?
Yeah,
I mean, the moment
so
that's spoiled in the poster, as we mentioned, right? When Frog 2 gets killed, there's still everybody else's story to be wrapped up. And yet there's, I don't know, less than half an hour of the movie left to do it all in. So pacing-wise, it's an unusual choice, but it's a great one because you're almost sick with adrenaline in that scene, and it makes you shaky and jittery for the last half hour as they're going through that warehouse and, you know, sort of wrapping up the last bits of the crime story.
Yeah, and it makes you, I mean, when you go into sort of something that comes very soon after, which is them staking out a car that they think is hot, just the weighting of that in contrast to this sequence that just gets your blood pumping is such a deliberate and manipulative in a good way, just a way to handle your audience. Like, because you're on edge, you're expecting the next thing to be, it's about to go down and nothing happens.
Yeah, it's not, well, what it would be in a more conventional action film now, even at the time, I think, would just be a continuous ramping up.
Yeah.
Right? The way that superhero movies have to end with 20 minutes of, you know, over-the-top action or something.
Right.
And this movie is much more dribs and drabs after that one big, sickening car chase.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to jump ahead to the next moment that really stuck with me, which is the moment that that phalanx of cop cars comes face to face with the getaway car, essentially, that has Frog 1 in the passenger seat. And at this point, Sal, because Frog 2 is out of the picture, Sal driving him around. They meet up with the cop cars in, it seems to be, the middle of the highway, right?
Yeah.
And it's really the first moment. I mean, you were talking earlier about how Doyle is so obsessed with Frog 1, but he never gets any actual confrontation with him. So this is really as close as they come.
Yeah.
Is this little moment with the windshield in between them. And there's that great almost close-up. I mean, a pretty close medium shot of Gene Hackman as he gives that little wave, stylized wave.
It's classic.
Which, if you think about it, he is, in a way, sarcastically quoting the wave that Fernando Rey gave him as the subway doors were closing and he was pulling away, right? And there's just, I just love that moment between them because you see how much both of their intelligence, their intuition, their, you know, use of force, everything that they have has gone in to this moment, trying to avoid it on one side and trying to make it happen on the other side, you know? But it's all just stated in that understated and almost snarky little wave.
And it's all so suspenseful because, again, I mean, one of the really interesting things about this latter half of the movie that I only noticed when I re-watched this last segment is that for so much of the film, that surveillance-y aspect is clear enough always that we don't doubt where the cops are relative to the things that we're watching. We generally know. But after they give the car back, we don't see the cops. We don't see the cops until they're on that bridge. And for me, there's just waiting for the other shoe to drop. Because we don't know if they put the drugs back in the car. You know, we don't know if they put a different something in the... We don't know. We don't know what they've done. And the cops disappear until they're on that bridge again. And it really made me think a lot about how much of the cops' gaze was a part of the film that I was watching, such that I could feel when it was no longer explicitly that gaze, watching the drug trade happen and then open the car back up to get the drugs, etc. Just not knowing where the cops are made me anxious in the way that a movie is supposed to make you feel at a moment like this, just a sense of what is going to happen? What is the plan? We don't hear it. We don't know.
You have to assume that they were being tailed at that point, but we never see the tail on them.
We don't see the tail. It's really nerve-wracking. And again, it's weird that I'm not cheering for either side here, really. I have to say there's not good people on both sides of this one, but still, I just feel this sense of what is going to happen.
Well, and then that last scene, you know, what does end up happening at the end, to me, looks forward so much to future scenes. I don't know how common it was in 1971 for there to be this broken down warehouse space that's almost like a horror movie space, you know, with the water dripping eerily and to have this final shootout there. But I felt like it was like Alien, you know, has scenes like that. Lots of space movies have those kind of spaces now that are all sort of mechanistic, industrial style space, but it's very broken down and decayed. Once again, without Friedkin ever having to point it out, or he doesn't even come anywhere near signposting it, but it's a place of urban decay, you know? It's a place of abandonment and despair and poverty, and all of that is just kind of in it, in the set.
I think a lot about Tarkovsky's Stalker in this regard.
I thought of that too. Yeah,
it's sort of one of those spaces, and it's, you know, these slow shots of, I mean, there's multiple things happening. There's other people being pursued and shot at, etc., and tear gas and all these things. But the Gene Hackman part, you can't really hear any of that other stuff. It's him in this abandoned space and a shadow in the corner. You know, it's just a very eerie and just seems to come like from a different world. I think symbolism is often very corny, but if there's really something to the isolation and desolation of where this guy lands in this movie and what happens in this space and the way that he accidentally kills a guy, a colleague who for the entire movie had been like, you're like that guy that gets cops killed. There's something so bleak about that. And I already feel the bleakness pretty much as soon as he's there and he's convinced himself that the Frog One is in this space, even though we don't really have indication of that. We see something, but we don't see that it's him.
Right. I mean, you talked about not knowing where the cops were in the previous scene. In this scene, you don't know where the bad guys are, right? I mean, the cops are bad guys, too, in this, but whatever, the drug dealer guys. And you don't know whether this hunch, right? I mean, Doyle's hunches sometimes work out, sometimes don't. We just saw one of them not work out at all when he shot his FBI colleague, which he seems creepily unconcerned with, right?
No.
I mean, Roy Scheider is having a moral moment there.
He's having that face, yeah.
But Hackman just, he immediately shifts to, I've got to find, I know he's here. I know Frog One is here. I've got to find him.
Because it'll be worth it somehow if he does find the guy.
Yeah, it's, and there's just an amorality to that
right.
that's so chilling, a
that's
note
chilling.
For the movie to end on.
Chilling.
And so off he goes. We ourselves don't know where Frog One has gotten to. We saw Sal Boca get shot earlier.
Right.
And by the way, can I just note, justice for Sal Boca, that sad moment when he and his brother, who have been separate for the whole movie,
right.
his brother who works at the junkyard and is
right.
in on the whole deal, this moment that they jump on each other and hug because it all came together. And then one of them, I think the brother says, I'll see you at Pops tonight. But of course, we know that one of them is not going to be a Pops that night. And it turns out to be Sal.
It's too bad. I kind of liked Sal.
Yeah, I'm telling you, he's Fredo.
Of all of them, you know, I don't know. I mean, he's just as bad as the others. I don't know why, but...
Something about running that grubby diner with the girlfriend in the wig.
I know. Just... I love his girlfriend. They're just like such a cute crook couple. And I just want them to have their thing. He got too ambitious. And he's just getting himself involved in these things that he just doesn't need to be involved in. And yeah, he gets killed.
But that happens in the general confusion before
yeah.
this stalker-like moment that we're talking about. And so now we're getting to what I think is the most mysterious moment in the movie. So after
yes.
the FBI agent is killed, we're back in stalker land with Gene, and he's wandering off into a room that we don't see deep into the shot.
Right.
And then there's a gunshot, and then the screen goes blank, and the movie is over. So
yeah.
who did he shoot just then, if anyone? We know that he didn't shoot Sal's brother because Sal's brother is in the title cards at the end as having been found guilty of narcotics charges or something like that, right? We know he didn't shoot Sal because Sal's already dead. We know he doesn't shoot Frog One because Frog One gets away.
Yeah.
Is it just a shot into nowhere? What does it mean?
First of all, this whole warehouse scene gets under my skin so much because I think I mentioned earlier that I spent a good amount of this film, or spent it rather, as I was watching it, thinking this is... incredible, and I still somehow don't know what it's about. Like, where are we going with this? Is this going to be moral comeuppance? Is this a movie where ultimately what the point is to solve a crime? Like, what kind of movie is this? And then for this ending to be what it is, it's after he shoots the cop, it's Roy Scheider's face versus his face is what the movie winds up being about for me. It's the fact that he leaves to even go shoot anyone,
mm-hmm.
that he walks away, which is something he does a lot in this movie after raining chaos and everything. Even when he shoots Frog 2, you know, there's not that moment that we get a lot of now where we get, you know, the CSIs come over and like all the other cops block off the street and someone handles the body, handles the crime scene. This is not a crime scene movie. This is he just moves on to the next thing. And that is chilling. that is like a whole terrain that, even though the movie has very plausibly been getting at it the entire time, it's very consistent with his character. I don't remember that from when I was 10. I did not think that we were ending on that note, which is really where, for me, the movie like leaps from like great to great, great.
It is, because it leaves it on that note of ambiguity where it could mean so many things. I
yeah.
mean, there could be paranoid fan theories about what it means,
yeah.
right? The most likely thing is probably that he was shooting at Frog One as Frog One was getting away.
Right.
But the fact that it's just this disconnected shot that doesn't seem to have anyone in the movie that it could legitimately be a shot at,
yeah.
means that the ending is, in a way, almost just about the continuance of pure violence.
Yeah, and even knowing where the real guys wound up in their lives does not mitigate the unsettling mystery of the end. It's like, okay, so the Gene Hackman character doesn't die. He's not the one getting shot at. He didn't shoot himself, and the French guy got away, so that's also not what happened. But really what happens at the end of the movie is that he very, very finally clarifies the kind of guy that he is to me. He just goes from being a guy that I'm afraid of because of how violent he is in ways that we see, but there's just like this abyss
yeah,
for me at the end
void.
Of it, where
yeah.
I'm just like, oh, you're like a whole other level of person. It's quite a performance that it all adds up to that. But the movie can only get away with that because of really believing that Gene Hackman is that guy for me. And
mm-hmm.
he really, and Roy Scheider, again, that face that he gives at the end where it's like, this was a line
mm-hmm.
and you,
yeah.
you definitely crossed it. Doesn't even matter. It's like shooting a guy in the back. Okay, fine. We'll all move past that. But this, like, actually, yeah, it's quite shaking for me.
Yeah, doing that and then also not connecting to the fact that he
yeah.
did it and moving on, right?
I guess, even caring.
I guess the last shot it doesn't mean only one thing, but what it's supposed to point to is, you know, exactly what Roy Scheider's character would have felt when he heard that shot. It was just, oh shit, there he goes again. He's not going to stop, you know.
Yeah. Great ending.
There is something like a comeuppance for them, although I think one that's not true to the real life story in those final title cards, because the fate that we hear about for them, right? Frog One gets away and was never caught and he's living in luxury. Lou Boca goes to jail for some small charge.
Right.
We hear about what happens to all these other people, but the last thing we hear about Cloudy, we haven't called him by his nickname yet, but the last thing we hear about Roy Scheider's character and Popeye is that they're assigned to a different case. And so that makes it sound as if they were being punished for their bad policing in this story. But in real life, and apparently Eddie Egan, the real life Popeye, objected to that card. In real life, they were not assigned to different cases until 4 years later. They actually continued to work together and solve other cases after that. And there was not a kind of causative, punitive relationship between the fact that they were split up as partners and what they had done on the French Connection case.
Right.
So, you know, maybe the movie is trying to make it a little bit tidier than it was in real life.
One of them just died.
Sonny Grosso?
January 22nd, 2020. Yeah.
R.I.P. Sonny Grosso. He's actually in the movie, too, along with Eddie Egan, although his part is so small, I don't even remember who he is. I think he's another FBI agent along with Muldrig, and I'm not sure that he has a line. But he and Egan were both around advising the whole time, which makes the darkness of this movie even more interesting. That the actual cops were there, and they let these portraits of them, particularly of Popeye, get out there.
Yeah. It's a very complicated movie, in part because I, as one of those cops, would not want this movie to be made because of my read on the movie. But if you're one of the people who is applauding, you know, the end of the chase scene, the shooting in the back in that theater, and you were one of the cops and you were hearing that, I think that maybe your impression of what this movie is doing maybe is different than what mine is. Again, I really do believe that people might have been applauding because it is just such a harrowing climax of that scene. I really think that it's sort of a thing that is just beyond morality. I think it's sort of one of those things where I didn't even think about the fact that the guy was being shot in the back until watching a special feature and they mentioned that they were anxious about it. Because he's the bad guy and he's shot with a sniper rifle before that he's not holding, and he also doesn't have a gun in this moment. So I absolutely, thinking about it, can see why it's bad. But I would bet maybe some people don't really read it the same way that we're reading it, with the same sense of not condemnation, just sense of, I think it's gross.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, if there were somebody curating a film series now about police brutality, this is a movie that should absolutely be in
totally.
It. Even though, as we said at the top, it's not a movie about police brutality. It's not setting out to address that issue. But the way that it's just folded into the movie with this unsettling naturalness, I think is precisely what makes it so fascinating in that connection.
Interestingly, Bonnie and Clyde had been released, and Pauline Kael's very famous rave review of that film is a huge moment in New Hollywood, as is that movie generally. But getting Bonnie and Clyde to be released, a very violent movie, was a huge part of just this wave of movies that we're talking about right now with French Connection. What's interesting is that she hated this movie. She called it Jolts for Jocks. But she says, quote, "There's nothing in the movie that you enjoy thinking about afterward. Nothing especially clever except the timing of the subway door and umbrella sequence. Every other effect of the movie, even the climactic car versus runway elevated train chase, is achieved by noise, speed, and brutality." And I agree with her description. And I also think that that's the thing that I walk out of it reflecting on. Just the noise, the sense of the street, the taking for granted of all the broader context. Bonnie and Clyde is a more explicitly psychological movie, and it's got other things going on. I mean, once you have Warren Beatty impotent in a movie, it's like a whole other category of Hollywood archetype and star power and classical arcs. It's just a different movie, a very violent one. It is interesting to me that this is somehow too far, because I feel the opposite to her, but I do see what she means in terms of how this could appeal to people in a particular way. But I think the movie is so much darker than that. I could not stop thinking about how dark it was at the end.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it might deliver jolts to some jocks does not mean that that's what it
doesn't
was
mean a bad movie
for, right?
Yeah,
but I do agree, Cam, that it's that final shot that takes the movie from the realm of a very well-made action movie with some interesting things to say about New York policing to, you know, something that's really profound and almost mythical.
Yeah, and terrifying. It's scary to think about the future in which that guy goes in to advise this movie. No shade to anybody, but shade.
That should have been his final title card. Eddie Egan went on to advise William Friedkin on this film.
I mean, like the end of Wolf of Wall Street, where it's like the real guy shows up and you're like, oh, you know, there's just a sense of you're not even in prison anymore. You're still here. And now you're in this movie. Now I feel gross. Yeah. Have you seen the sequel?
No. It's directed by John Frankenheimer, which is a crazy detail, but it was not very well received. Did you see it?
No, I was afraid to because I didn't want to dilute the beauty of this one, but I'm going to have to.
It's Popeye once more. Gene Hackman's in it and Fernando Rey is in it. And I think it basically is imagining, you know, well, what if Popeye went to France and continued to chase after in Marseille? I mean, just purely for the Gene Hackman element, I might see the French Connection too.
Sure.
Now, but it's almost bound to be a disappointment.
I mean, where do you go from the end of this movie? There's no story. That is the end. That tells me everything I need.
All right. Well, I guess we're done with the French Connection, feeling all uneasy and queasy as we walk out through the dripping warehouse into the night. So what do you have for us next time?
Okay. I have a movie that I'm so excited for us to do because I've never talked about it with anyone, but it is one of my favorite movies. I'm just going to describe the premise first. Maybe people haven't heard of the movie and I just want to entice everyone. The premise is, three women are on a day trip and they get a letter from a fourth woman saying, hey, ladies, I ran off with one of your husbands.
Oh, yeah.
And they spend the entire movie reassessing their marriages and also building toward the end of the day when they're off of the day trip and they all go home and they find out whose husband got stolen. The movie is A Letter to Three Wives from 1949 by Joseph Mankiewicz. It's the film that he made the year before All About Eve, which is definitely the more famous movie, I would say. All About Eve won Best Picture and Director and Writing. And this was up for all of those awards, but this is where he won Writing for the first time and Directing. He didn't win Best Picture. I think this movie is every bit the equal of All About Eve in terms of its writing. I rewatched it recently and was pretty blown away. It's like All About Eve. It has a very curious and here more daring, I think, use of voiceover. You hear the fourth woman, you never see her. And it's such a sharp class study. And it's Mankiewicz. You know, he was a master of turning dialogue into just this insightful, perceptive, and sharp, and beautifully performed action. He just makes people talking. I mean, you think about All About Eve. You just think about how lush the writing is with also how much it gives someone like Betty Davis to do.
Yeah, and more quotable lines than almost any movie you can think of, right?
And this movie is... Man, I rewatched it recently and was pretty blown away by the range of things this movie shows you about these respective marriages, but also just the acting. It's just crazy good movie. And I feel like people have not seen it. I really feel like I didn't hear about it until I was just sort of on a Mankiewicz kick one day a number of years ago and just decided to watch this other movie that he won all these Oscars for. 1949.
Oh, that's a great choice. 1949, Letter to Three Wives.
Streaming on iTunes, Amazon, Google, etc. For rental. Highly, highly recommend this movie, particularly if you love a film like All About Eve. Just ridiculously smartly written women characters in particular, but also the male characters. Kirk Douglas in this movie, fantastic. Just can't say enough positive things about this movie, so I'm excited.
Oh, I haven't seen this in so long. I love this choice. All right, thanks, Cam. So we will reconvene in 2 weeks to talk about Letter to Three Wives. Our producer is Chow Tu, and as always, if you want to write us about this show or ideas for future movies that we should talk about, you can write us at flashback@slate.com. So thanks, as always, to Kay Austin Collins of Vanity Fair, and thanks to all of you for being Slate Plus subscribers. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.